Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum, discussing Twilight and the Desert, the coming Saudi oil shock, and its implications. I'm Tim Weiskill, a member of the Forum's board. Each week, Cambridge Forum brings you live public discussions of issues and ideas that are shaping our world. Is this the end of the age of cheap oil? Western economies are already feeling the sting of rising oil prices. Add increasing energy demands from developing nations, especially China and India, to political instability in many of the oil-producing nations, and both prices and demand seem destined to increase even more, leading to unprecedented instability in the world energy market. Oil industry analyst Matthew Simmons adds the possibility that Saudi Arabia's oil production could soon face a serious and irreversible decline to this. And this scenario raises the issue, what will the world economy look like when Saudi petroleum reserves peak? Rather than hope for the discovery of new petroleum resources, Simmons presents a blueprint for a global economy as oil production declines. What role does he see for conservation, for alternative energy sources? Matthew Simmons is chairman of Simmons & Company International, a Houston-based investment bank that specializes in the energy industry. He's a member of the National Petroleum Council and the Council on Foreign Relations. He draws on more than 30 years of insider experience in the global energy industry in his book, Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock and the World Economy. And that is what serves as the basis for our discussion this evening. Welcome to Cambridge Forum, Matthew Simmons.
Thank you very much. I've had the pretty remarkable experience in the course of the last year of speaking far more than I ever thought I'd do in my life at various forums around the world. I've spoken at quite a few universities, including a fabulous day here on the February 8th, where I spoke at, I think, four different schools at Harvard and then at the Science Center. But I've also enjoyed speaking engagements at Uppsala University in Sweden, at the University of Aberdeen, at the Northwestern University of Texas, the Midland College, where 1,100 people showed up a few weeks ago, but I've never spoken in a church. And ironically, I think that since so many people have said, do you think I need to pray about this? I'd say, well, that's better than ignoring the problem. So maybe I think this is probably an appropriate forum. It's also interesting, I have two more talks to give before I retire for the summer in Maine, and second to last is a week from tomorrow evening in Crystal City, Virginia. Now, for those that you don't know where Crystal City, Virginia is, its biggest building there is called the Pentagon, and I'm told it'll be primarily the top brass, which I gather is a word that for some of our top military thinkers, and they basically said, we really want PowerPoints. We want a handful of points, and we want them powerful, because we're going to have all the best military intelligence. And basically, it's called an evening conversation in Washington, D.C., how we end our addiction. I thought, isn't that interesting? An evening conversation in Washington, D.C., how we end our addiction. They don't even have to say oil. So we've come a long ways in this discussion. It's an honor also for me to speak about this important topic of the future of energy in such a historic setting. And also, I have to say that Cambridge, Soldiers Field, Beacon Hill, Back Bay, Greater Boston, and now Midcoast Maine have been a very special part of my life. For a guy raised on the slopes of the Wasatch Mountains in Davis County, Utah, I never really imagined how impacting this area would be. My first visit to Boston was on August 1962, which is 44 years ago. I came back to start what was meant to be 2 years at Harvard Business School in September 1965, which was 41 years ago. 39 years ago this week, I graduated, and then I returned in the fall to spend 2 years working on the Harvard Business School faculty as a researcher, a job I still ironically still have, but not as part of any faculty. 37 years ago this week, I met a lovely girl, and 2 years later, I married her, and this Thursday night, we celebrate our 35th wedding anniversary. My quick 2 years at Harvard didn't turn out to be that way because we stayed here for a decade before we moved to Houston in 1974, but we came back again and again. And we now spend almost as much time in Mid-Coast Maine overlooking Penobscot Bay as what we do from our home in Houston, Texas. So while my energy views have been profoundly shaped by being a Houstonian for a long time, my love to research and sense of responsibility to speak out on serious matters, whether pleasant or not, have been shaped strongly by my New England ties. A year ago, the book that I spent 2.5 years researching and writing, primarily on Penobscot Bay, had just reached bookstores. I had no idea how it would be received. I knew that it would be extremely controversial, as there had already been about 100 stories written about the notion that Saudi Arabia might be nearing the end of its ability to always provide the world's largest supply of oil, and I had an awful lot of senior people say that's absolutely crazy. In the course of the last year, I've given more energy talks than I ever could have dreamed of 10 years ago. I've had thousands of letters and email from people from key places and just ordinary people commenting on the book, giving me even better inside scoop. Even some senior people with Inside Aramco have given me some better inside scoop, and some of that information is contained in the new introduction in the paperback. How right I will be, actually we're going to know soon, because I suspect that by 2010 there will be no more controversy. Either some miracle is going to happen, or we will have witnessed twilight in the Middle East oil, being seen as so abundant and cheap that the world could continue using inexpensive energy forever. In my serious and strong opinion, we now no longer might have an energy crisis someday. We are now no longer approaching some mythical form or point where prices spike, demand plummets, supply soars. The crisis is also not decades away. It arrives silently, as the fog does in Maine. And as of June 12, 2006, we now are into a very serious energy crisis. Like most world-class crises, the pain's still low, the casualties are few, but we've now crossed the proverbial Rubicon. Energy demand grew too fast. Energy supply came from too few old sources. Spare capacity was silently eaten away. Aging assets quietly rusted. Talented, trained, skilled energy technicians retired. Few young people came into the world's largest and most important industry. Energy prices stayed too low for too long, and then someone decided to trade energy prices on commodity exchanges. Let's let traders bet on what future prices can be. It became a new paradigm. Traders always know best. And at the end of a 20-year, 5-year collapse of low energy prices, the experts, by the end of the century, thought that this glut would last forever. And while the low price was killing off any chance for a pleasant energy future, suddenly, out of the blue, oil prices started to head north. Not in a straight line, to be sure, but north in oil price terms by a factor of 7 times in just 7 years. But the pricing signals, what economists believe wake people up, the price signals as sharp as a jolt of electricity in a prison's death chair were simply ignored as abnormal, or as fear premiums driven by wars, rumors of wars, hedge funds. There were several times last year that even the publication of the only book I've ever written, Twilight in the Desert, occasionally got blamed on the reason oil prices were so abnormally high. So we all slept while we ran out of high-quality oil and dry natural gas. We slept when America, China, and Europe's black high BTU coal got used up. We panicked when a single nuke, a bad word for clean atomic energy, had a problem, but its fail-safe systems worked. We violently overreacted when a single blow-up preventer in the Santa Barbara Channel failed in January 1969 and unleashed an army of well-intentioned guardians of the Earth to stop any and all new energy projects, calling them dirty, unpleasant, too risky for economies built on tourism. Even here in New England, a region that lacks any domestic oil, natural gas, coal, and only a tiny amount of hydro, active and powerful forces kept all offshore waters strictly off limits to even try to inventory natural gas. In Maine, we tore down a multi-billion dollar nuclear plant, all because it had been shabbily maintained. We fought off everything, and last October, I painfully read the New England Power Pool report warning that if New England had a real cold snap, the likelihood of a winter blackout was high. God looked after New England last winter. Winter never came. But we squandered this miracle too and still angrily fight windmills, dangerous LNG, which in fact might be dangerous, any form of energy. What America led the world to believe, and we preached this belief for 50 years, was that we had some endowed right to use cheap energy. The USA was once the largest producer of oil, gas, and coal in the world. We're still the world's largest consumer of all three, but we let our guard down and became far more bigger importer of oil than even Japan at its most vulnerable point. We peaked in oil and gas production in the United States 3 decades ago, but no one even wondered whether this would lead to our twilight as a superpower, just as England suffered when King Coal faded. Instead, we all kept telling each other, Middle East oil is abundant, Middle East oil is cheap, they need money and we need their oil. We were perfect partners. Then we pretended that North America had so much natural gas that we buried our heads in the sand when an explosive drilling boom did not even budge supply. We then got so wrapped up in touting LNG as a rescue that no one seemed to notice that no plants were being built, let alone any serious source of gas being truly discovered to send to all these mythical terminals. We all lived in an energy dream, and it was a pleasant dream, but it was a dream. Oil and gas globally are at a high risk to be safely sustained at the current level. If supply could be goosed up a few percent, it is as risky as a boy climbing higher on a ladder that's going to ultimately fall. Oil and gas prices are high for sticker shock, but in fact, they're still far too low. $75 a barrel sounds high, but when you divide it into something humans can understand, it's 11 cents a cup. 11 cents a cup. $3.20 motor gasoline is 20 cents a cup. Sounds trivial to have a cup of motor gasoline, but if you put it in a car, you can get 6 people almost 2 miles for 20 cents. Natural gas prices should sell for a solid premium over oil. So when oil prices were 65, natural gas prices at 16 were parity, but they should have been 30. Electricity is cheap. The current price needs to probably rise, and it will rise. Low prices are a curse. They simply fuel our addiction to cheap energy. So that consumers can afford costly bottled water and go to a sports event for far more than what my wife and I spent this weekend driving almost 600 miles from Houston to Fort Worth and back. Our Mercedes diesel used almost a tank of gas, and that cost me almost $55 to refill this morning. My daughter spent as much on Sundays to sit in the bleachers to see the Red Sox play ball. Doesn't make any sense. We will all change our use of oil as we'll be forced to change. We'll stop clogging our highways with large trucks, bringing goods across the country from China to Maine. We'll end our compulsion to ship blueberries from Chile to Maine or apples from New Zealand to England in English summer. It simply uses too much energy. We'll liberate our workforce and encourage people to work wherever they want, whenever they want, and pay by productivity, tearing up our long-standing social contract to check in every day from 9 to 5 to keep it a good job. And that is how we will basically solve peak oil. Solving the use of natural gas is far harder and a more serious issue. Natural gas is heat, the only truly efficient way to heat. Someday, we might unleash heat deep in the ground. But until then, substituting electricity for it made by any feedstock is a very poor way to heat. The crisis is real. The crisis is serious. There are still many dreamers who say, wait, oil prices will fall below 40 or even below 20. Lord Brown at BP said that, was quoted in that this morning. Others say, wait until high prices unlock so much heavy oil, tar sands, and even oil shale that we'll be in a glut again. But they're dreamers, and they grossly ignore the energy intensity of turning low-quality energy into usable energy. They're all dreamers, and we're now in the early days of an energy war. We dreamed too long, but now we have to awake and have to have a call to arms so we can fight and hopefully win our energy war. So I thank you for the opportunity to frankly and honestly discuss this crisis, and I look forward to just as frank an exchange in questions. I'm pleased to be here. Thank you.
You are joining us at Cambridge Forum, listening to Matthew Simmons discussing twilight in the desert. In your closing few sentences, you mentioned the statement this morning, at least reported this morning on the BBC, of Lord Brown. He actually predicts that in the short run, there's not really much we can do about energy prices, but in the long run, by which he meant from 5 to 10 years, he's suggesting that the oil prices will go down by a factor of a half. In other words, it'll be about a half of what they are now. Your previous statement a little earlier in the talk was that low oil prices are a curse. Is it time to tell Lord Brown that he's a curse?
You know, I don't know where he's coming from. I don't know Lord Brown. I've heard him talk quite a few times. I've shaken his hand. When I came to Harvard University and gave the first university-wide talk on the future of energy, 1 month later, Ian Conn, who's a very senior BP executive and colleague, came to Harvard, and basically, I didn't hear his talk. I just got this off their website, and he basically says, "I'll be covering a current and forward look at the world of energy. This means making some forecasts. The future is unpredictable, but our industry has a critical role." But then he goes on and shows how demand is going to grow and grow and grow because China's growing, India's growing, populations are growing. So he finally says, "So the natural question is, are we going to run out of fossil fuels in the near future?" My answer is no. And I have four reasons for saying this. First, official data is often open to challenge, but it's the best data we have. Second, there are unconventional fuel sources that do not appear in official data. Heavy oil, tar sands, oil shale. Third, most of the data covers only proven reserves, and our experience from exploration continues to suggest that there are significant resources to find. Their finding record has been terrible the last 10 years, but they're still optimistic. Fourth, technology is not only helping us find new reserves and enhance recovery rates, but it's helping make coal and other hydrocarbons clean. I'm sure they're well-intentioned, and I'm also just as sure they're wrong. And I think actually that the most dangerous people in this whole game right now are the people that are saying, you know, be comfortable, just wait. Prices are going to come down. It's not in the cards.
Well, given that, we also have a politics of perpetual optimism, not only the investment community driven by the notion of overprojection and the like so they can still attract investments, but we have an electoral system that's based on a kind of plebiscite every 2 years on the premise that they can promise more than the other guy. So how do you look at the interaction between the political system we're saddled with and the economic system we find ourselves in?
You know, interestingly, last summer I had the opportunity of co-editing an editorial piece called 50 Years of Energy Mistakes, and my co-author was Stuart Udall, who was celebrating his 50th anniversary of being an elected congressman, and he became probably the greatest Secretary of Interior during the Kennedy-Johnson years. And it was so, we both thought it sort of ironic that we both come from more pioneer stock. That's sort of an old pioneer term, doesn't mean cattle. And yet he's been a Democrat all his life. He's been a public policy person. I was meant to be a commercial banker in Utah till I got hooked on energy, and I've been a Republican all my life. One thing Stuart Udall brought to this paper with his unique background, 50 years of energy mistakes. He was talking about 25 administrations and 8 presidencies. So this is a nonpartisan deal. What happened is America just believed that basically we had unlimited amounts of energy, and it became a religion. But I'll tell you what I'm really encouraged about right now is that there are a growing number of people in Washington, and I'm going to be there for tomorrow and the next day and then a week later on this talking to the brass, and they are basically starting to really, really understand the gravity of this. Many of you probably know Secretary Bodman because he taught at MIT. Sam Bodman understands what's going on. That's why he asked the National Petroleum Council on the 5th of October to do the most thorough study ever on peak oil. I was a little bit embarrassed on behalf of the National Petroleum Council. It took until 2 weeks ago for them to finally decide to do the study, and they're going to call it sort of, you know, various views on global oil and gas, and I'm about to meet Wednesday morning with a person heading the project for Exxon and say, if you're planning a whitewash, tell me now, and I'll resign and hold my press conference. But offsetting that, Congressman Bartlett, who is a fabulous, almost 83-year-old congressman from Frederick, Maryland. He's a Republican. He's been in Congress now, I think, 16 years. He's got his PhD in science. He formed the first Peak Oil Caucus in November, and I think they now have 45 congressmen on board.
Well, it's interesting that you point to the fact that it's more than party political. It's kind of cultural in our assumption. We are a culture that expanded upon a frontier, in some sense always thought there was more beyond that frontier. It's led some to observe, especially from Europe, that we may be the last of the flat earth society, in the sense that we think there's still a flat frontier out there. Having expanded upon the things of nature, we think that expansion is in the nature of things. And it's not quite true with any finite resource, whether it's copper, oil, or whatever else. How would you get a culture that's addicted to expansion to focus on the, as it were, the economics of finite resources?
You know, what I find interesting is that this isn't an American problem. Because of the nature of America, we just happen, because, I mean, it's culturally acceptable in America to basically be in Seattle and say, I think I might drive to Florida. But when you get to Europe, it's really hard to find a person that's driven from Aberdeen, Scotland, to London. They just don't think about doing that. So having been as critical as I've spoken around England as I am in the United States, I find it really interesting when people say, well, why don't you instruct your own country? And I say, well, you know, you use three times as much diesel fuel shipping goods by trucks than we do. And it's semi-trucks. I mean, semi-trucks are basically four times the problem of an SUV. So I actually think it's not just a U.S. problem. It's a global problem, and I'm sure that the U.S. can't solve this problem by Fortress America. We can lead the world in being educated that we have to basically start using less oil.
Very good. You are joining us at Cambridge Forum, listening to Matthew Simmons discussing Twilight and the Desert. The floor is now open for audience questions. Please come up to the microphone and pose your question.
What you outline is really revolutionary. Could you spend a bit more time? What are the alternatives in keeping the same standard of living?
Well, first let me just say that I'm not an expert in all aspects of conservation. In fact, I really didn't pay a lot of attention. I've been spending all my time on trying to understand demand and supply, and I finally, as I was finishing the book, said, you know, I don't want to end it on such a sour note. And I worked very hard to figure out this chapter I called Aftermath. And one change in the paperback, I totally rewrote chapter 17 because I realized in 8 months I'd thought and thought and talked that I knew so much more about this. But I'm a little surprised that actually the ideas that I dreamed up were so revolutionary because they were so simple. And I think it's a little bit sad that so many people didn't basically just sit back and say, you can't basically come up with a new car. We have 220 million vehicles on the road, and it takes almost 30 years for them to take over. So that was just a concept. You can encourage people to drive less. The way you do that is not scolding people. You basically talk to employers, and you say, you know, your people are all mad when they get to work, because they're all mad when they get to work. They're mad because they've been stuck in traffic, and they're mad they have to stay there until 5. We have a fabulous mayor in Houston, Mayor Bill White, who basically ran 2.5 years ago. He was so controversial, people didn't think he had a chance. He was a Democrat. I'm a Republican. I became his treasurer. I was told he doesn't have a chance. When he was reelected with 92% of the vote, he had a chance. Bill White gathered the top 100 business leaders in Houston. And he basically said, our highway system now is done. We can't expand it anymore. We already have congestion. We have to solve peak travel. It's up to you to figure out how to liberate your workforce. So I think Houston, Texas is going to be the white city on a hill to actually start showing America and the world how you can basically have people happier on flexible work hours and so forth. So all of these changes are going to have to happen. Whole Foods, another Texas company, decided that they would actually promote, they cleverly call it organic food. That's just food grown in local sources, and it tastes so much better. And they became a fabulous success. So I think that basically these things aren't very hard to do, but you don't do them by saying, well, let's just let people kind of do it. This is a war. And I think we have to look at it as a war, because if we don't look at it as a war, we're going to all lose.
As I'm sure you're aware, during the Second World War, Germany supplied a lot of its oil needs by the Fischer-Tropsch process, breaking coal into fuel. And I've heard that, you know, oil has to hit a certain price before that becomes economical, but I've also heard that that's around the price we're at today. And I believe we have, you know, hundreds of years of coal reserves in the country. I was just wondering in your comments as to whether we're going, that's going to be major future.
First of all, it's a good question because there are a lot of people that basically are saying, well, there isn't a problem. Gas to liquids is actually a fabulous source. Turns out that Germany's great use of what became then went to Sasol in South Africa, Fischer-Tropsch, it was almost a technology that was several decades old by the time of World War II, and it's still the best thing around today. But what's interesting is that there was a story that I read on the plane coming up today saying that Qatar has finally become the world's biggest gas-to-liquid producer, a plant that's going to come on stream in the next few months, and it will produce 34,000 barrels a day. 34,000 barrels a day from the world is using 85 million barrels a day of oil. And I don't know that there's any good data we even have the coal. So I think that's a nice alternative if you're living in an area where you don't have any oil, but it isn't a solution.
As a student of climate science, I failed to notice any mention of climate shock or climate chaos now occurring as a result of our carbon loading the atmosphere. With CO2 levels now 40% higher than at any point in the last 750,000 years, you nevertheless claim that natural gas is, quote, the only truly efficient way to heat. In light of the rapidly worsening global climate situation, can you explain why solar hot water and geothermal are not valid options for us to embrace?
Yeah. Geothermal is fabulous if you happen to live where there's presence of geothermal, but it doesn't travel. The hardest thing in the world to do is take steam coming out of the ground and send it long distances unless you have some other form of energy. So it's just I did rapidly mention that I think so far the only thing I can even imagine to solving the declining of natural gas is to figure out some ways to tunnel into closer to the center of the Earth and tap what we basically call the magma that we only occasionally see when we have geothermal or when a volcano goes off. I mean, everyone's very nervous right down in Indonesia. They're going to blow the big one, as they say, and so forth. But again, I've really tried to separate some of the heated political issues like climate change. I think climate change is very serious, but ironically, if we actually have a rapid decline in fossil fuels, then we actually start to eliminate why we think we have climate change. And then it's going to be very uncomfortable if we find out we still have climate change. But I just think that what we really need to do is realize the uniqueness of natural gas and don't start some solutions that are basically electricity-driven because they're three times the BTU in as natural gas is. So it really is clean. But its efficiency is its phenomenal thing.
I remember about earlier in your program, you mentioned 3 decades ago we peaked in energy. Turns out 3 decades ago I had a job. I was working on oil rigs. I worked in the North Sea, in the Gulf of Mexico, Louisiana, West Africa. But I'm from Damariscotta, so hi, neighbor. Anyway, I couldn't help but notice the guys' hard hats working on oil rigs don't really get the full picture, but you can see how things are done differently, different parts of the world. You did mention the moratorium off of the Atlantic coast. I may have the numbers a little skewed, but I think about 80 million barrels a day. I think America consumes maybe 18 of that or something like 22-23%, despite that we have 6% of the world's population, something like that. 6% using 23% seems like kind of skewed and kind of almost offensive that we who use such a disproportionate amount of the oil would insist on no drilling because it doesn't look nice. And what it does is it puts the realities of production and transportation and exploration out of our minds so we don't think about the ecological compromises made elsewhere. I wonder if you've probably addressed that in your book. I think it would be a good idea to rethink that when and if we get an environmentally conscientious administration in Washington, which may not happen for a while.
I'll tell you what's really interesting, and again, I just just by happenstance, I'm headed to Washington tomorrow. Wednesday morning, I'm meeting with two congressmen that pulled off close to a miracle about 6 weeks ago, and they can go back and try to finish it. A congressman from Pennsylvania, John Peterson, who I've yet to meet, but I will this morning, teamed up with a Republican, teamed up with a Democrat, Chet Edwards, who's a Harvard Business School graduate, and his district is around Waco. And they basically got the largest coalition imaginable and came within 15 votes, 8 swing votes, of lifting all the drilling bans around all our outer continental shelf, period, to go on an urgent search for natural gas. And they failed by eight votes would have made the difference. And it was really interesting to then get the transcript and read this passionate night on the House floor of all of these foes saying, you can't drill for natural gas, you'll spill it on our beaches. Natural gas is a vapor. It doesn't spill. You can't drill for natural gas. It'll ruin Florida's tourist business. So one of the things that I'm suggesting to Congressman Edwards and Congressman Peterson is take one of these junkets. Congressmen always love to go on junkets. And take all of these foes and take them to Aberdeen. We have an office in Aberdeen. Aberdeen, you'd have to show pictures today, was a really grimy old mill city. Kind of past its peak before the North Sea miracle. And now 30 years later, almost 20 billion barrels of pumping oil. The west coast of Norway, the east coast of Scotland has never looked prettier. It shines. And so this idea that we couldn't ever have modern energy, would we ruin the environment? It was just, I mean, it was so easy to go to Scotland and Norway and just look with your eyes. What encourages me is that there were 207 congressmen, including a passionate, it was funny, Chet Edwards was telling me that when he first was a freshman congressman, he was seated next to the congressman from Hawaii, who basically had hair coming down to his waist. And Chet's this clean-cut Harvard Business School guy that came within 100 votes of knocking off his Texas A&M College professor, Phil Graham, when he first ran at the age of 26. And basically, he said, we were about as different as you can be, but we've become good friends. So the guy from Hawaii was a supporter. So it's there were quite a few from upstate New York. I don't think there was a single person in the New England delegation that supported this, but it was amazing how many people in a lot of other parts of the states, including quite a few Californians, that actually supported this. So it's got to happen. We probably run out the clock. I'm not sure it'll actually, you know, make any difference to stave off the problem, but it'll make a big difference if 10 years from now we actually have a kind of at least some renewal. So it was a great question.
I was intrigued by a statement that you made in an article on the subject last year, in which you said, as far as I know, there's not a single contingency plan in place or currently being written by any of the think tanks of the world that sets out a model illustrating how the world can continue to function smoothly once it is clear that Saudi Arabia oil has peaked. Okay, well, there is such a study. In fact, there's a series of studies by Amory Lovins and his colleagues at the Rocky Mountain Institute that shows how conservation and renewable energy can be combined to provide those needs. But I think the real problem, it seems, is that it doesn't provide profit opportunities for investment bankers, and it's not consistent with the hegemonic American foreign policy goals of the Council of Foreign Relations. Isn't this really where the rub comes in discussing this issue with us or discussing the issue with the top brass at the Pentagon, where we're headed with energy policy and for whose benefits?
Well, I don't know. I don't have anything to do with that. But I'll tell you, I had a really interesting Amory Lovins, Bill Richardson, governor of New Mexico, and I both, all three spoke at a sustainability of the Rocky Mountains at Colorado College, where the president was the former governor of Ohio and former head of the Peace Corps and ambassador to India. And afterwards, we had a long, interesting conversation. I've read Amory's stuff. Some of his ideas are absolutely fabulous, and a lot of them just don't work. The problem I have with Amory is a little bit like the problem I have with Exxon. He makes it sound so easy to kick the oil habit, and yet if you could separate out some of his fabulous work in composites, it's spectacular. But he seems to be someone now that he never thought that it was a problem having oil. And now that he's starting to worry, he's getting a little bit more realistic about some solutions and how long they take. So I think in the whole way, we've got to take the politics out of it. We've got to take the anger out of it. We've got to take the blame out of it. I mean, it was everybody's fault. But I don't think for a second that there's some sort of a great conspiracy. I think there's a conspiracy of being asleep. I mean, the Wall Street investment banks haven't a clue. I'm not real friendly with them either. But they had nothing to do with basically, trying to, hook people on, we did it to ourselves.
Your book has been controversial. Could you give us an idea of what you think is the most controversial point, or one or two or three points in the book? And is it the Saudi Arabian issue of the decline of their reserves? And then give us an idea of what experts, maybe the credentials and even agendas of those people who happen to agree with you, and similarly for those who disagree with you, who are they and what are their backgrounds, and do they have an agenda as well?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what really surprised me, first of all, and I've laid this out in the new introduction in the paperback, is that I thought I would spend at least the summer and the fall just being attacked every single day for being so stupid and being so forth. And it turned out that there were less than 10 written critiques, and the funniest one, the guy was so annoyed it didn't get mentioned, he came back about 6 weeks ago and wrote a pamphlet that's being distributed now for $10 a copy at the University of Boulder, some think tank. It's called Corn Circles in the Desert. And one chapter is The Dog That Didn't Bark. And the other chapter is Eyes Wide Shut. And so Michael Lynch, who actually is in Winchester or Amherst, he used to work for Dr. Edelman at MIT, he basically just thinks it's the dumbest book in the world. And he is by far the most outspoken critic. And he basically says, and I'm trying to do a very honest job because I'm sure he'll actually hear this tape, he basically says that it's all a matter of odds. And sure, Gawar could die. But in his Corn Circle book, he said it would be through something like a meteorite hitting the Earth. And if a meteorite were going to hit the Earth and hit an oil field, it would be most likely to be Gawar because it's the world's largest oil field. And then he says, sure, the dog that didn't bark, what's that all about? All these papers that Simmons basically talks about were delivered at SB forums around thousands of people, and nobody else actually barked. They didn't see anything wrong. It's typical of a Harvard MBA to think they know more than anyone else does. So he actually got all of his enemies. But what's interesting is that there were less than 10 firms or individuals that actually took time to write something. Now, the biggest critics I have, as far as I know, because I get told this all the time, or the CEOs of Exxon, the CEO of BP, half the time the CEO of Shell Oil Company, and Dan Yergin, the Pulitzer Prize winning author of Cambridge Energy Research Associates, whose offices used to be right over here. And then Claude Mandel, the head of the IEA in Paris, who I was told by a documentary from the Australian Broadcasting Company is doing a documentary that will air on the 25th of June, and when they came to Galveston, because I was there speaking, and for 2 hours shot me, they said, Claude Mandel, the head of the IEA in Paris, he was really nasty about you. And he basically told us a bunch of stuff in your book that we had to say, Mr. Mandel, we both read the book. It doesn't say that. Well, I think it does. So those were the critics, and they weren't very many. What was the most heartening thing for me in the world was to start hearing from people, like there's a fabulous person up in Eugene, Oregon, named Dr. Walter Yonquist. Walter Yonquist has trained three-quarters of this generation and last generation's petrophysicists. He worked with Dr. Hubbard at Shell. He basically has written me so many times, about every 6 weeks, I just skimmed through parts of your book again. No one has ever written a better book about reservoir engineering. I went to Tulsa to speak, and this guy came up to me. I didn't have any idea who he was. He said, I got to tell you. He said, you did a real number. He said, you made all of our textbooks so awful that we're probably going to have to just use yours. And I said, Matt, do you know that this is the dean of the Petroleum School at University of Tulsa? So I started hearing from senior people within Saudi Aramco, real senior people, said, you know what? I loved your book. What they thought was that this stupid book, and they really did think it was a stupid book, was being written by the stupid guy in Houston claiming that Saudi Arabia had no more oil and that these great oil fields had been destroyed through incompetence. And any of you read the book will read that I praise the high heaven, the motive of Saudi Arabia. They really thought they could be the swing producer and keep prices down. And then as they started having these problems, they started using technology faster than anybody. Who's Schlumberger's best customer in the world today? Saudi Aramco. Who's Halliburton? Saudi Aramco. Who's Baker Hughes? But the problem is, it wasn't their fault that they only had a handful of old fields, and the fields got too old. So when you start getting praise from senior vice presidents of Saudi Aramco, and then guys saying, you know, you might be interested in a paper I also wrote that sort of sheds some light, it leaves very little doubt in my mind that I could have been wrong, unless there's a miracle that happens that we couldn't have seen.
You were on Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force. And
wrong.
Really? No, every place, any magazine you're mentioned, it's always like Matt Simmons, who was on. And
yeah.
I just want to explain how that
question.
Rumor started, perhaps, or has anybody in the administration contacted you since the book came out, too?
First of all, I try to stop media people all the time when they say, now, what role exactly? I say, they didn't have any role. And I'm not hiding from the fact that I know I edited every single word that went into the comprehensive energy plan that was put forward by Governor George W. Bush, and I'm told that I provided maybe 85 to 90% of the ideas, so for better or worse. But what was embarrassing was that the day after the inauguration was on a Saturday, the day before the inauguration, California had its worst blackout since World War II. There were energy problems all over, so all of these problems I was warning people about as Bush was running for president came true. And so the first thing they did Sunday morning was convene in the White House and said, we better basically, formalize this energy plan. And so the task force were cabinet officers. Andrew Lundquist, who had been chief of staff at the Senate Energy, became the executive director. He got a staff of seven people, and they worked and they worked and they worked and they worked to fill out and flush out and make more readable this comprehensive energy plan. And what made so many people mad is they kept saying, we want to come tell you what the problem is. I said, we don't need them to tell us what the problem is. We're trying to document what we know is the problem. And out of that came all this stuff about, Enron. It had nothing to do with it. Enron had so little input in the whole thing, it's amazing. So, but are there people now in Washington? I mean, first of all, I don't have any idea whether the president's read the book, but I do know he has the book. I know Sam Bodman has the book. I know quite a few senior people in Washington have told me that they think it's really one of the more important books that has been written in a long period of time. So I think it's had input. I'd like to think it might have had a little bit of input in what I think we can look back and say was one of the more important statements ever in the State of the Union. It's time for America to end its addiction to oil.
Embarrassed to ask a venal question, but what are the investment implications of this?
I was worried what a venal question was. No, I think that's a fair question because the energy is the largest industry on Earth, and basically when something big sea change happens, I think it's important to say what's it mean for my investments. And what I say to a lot of, we have some of our best institutional clients that are here in greater. Cambridge, usually mostly in downtown Boston, and we guess all the time. If your thesis is correct, then it sure sounds like it's going to be, how does that impact how we invest? And my standard answer, because I'm no longer even following, we have some fabulous people in our firm that can tell you the most accurate models on what all these companies are going to earn each quarter, but I just don't get into that. But I said the first thing I do is go through your portfolio and make sure you don't have it all in things that basically are going to get killed by this. Because they're winners and losers in every major trend. I look at the airline business and say, even with low oil prices, the airlines were losing billions of dollars. Now with high oil prices, they're losing more billions of dollars. Or General Motors. They basically fell asleep at the wheel and created a pension plan that busted them. And then they didn't realize their cars weren't very good. And so now they're basically trying... For all things, three weeks ago, because rebates are really now unpopular with their board and some of the investors, so they're now offering free gasoline because they're sure that gas prices are going to come down. So I wouldn't probably want to have all my nest egg in the airlines and big autos from Detroit. But I also think that there are a lot of the infrastructure companies, the engineering companies, the valve companies, the fitting companies, they're going to have a day in the sun the likes of which of companies that were building Liberty ships. So I think that there are some ways to reposition your portfolio to make sure that you're sort of invested in the right things.
You mentioned the importance of drilling for more natural gas and the fact that we were kind of blessed in the Northeast with a mild winter, which, as you know, has led to an inventory build. What happens in, you know, they're saying September when all the storage facilities are full? That's the question, but let's say it doesn't happen. Yeah. First, I'd like to know when you think it happens, but when it does happen, let's say we have another mild winter and it happens next year. Yeah. What, do they just cap off the wells and stop drilling, or what happens?
Well, probably, if that happens, gas prices will collapse, you know, because traders will panic, say, oh, my gosh, we're just washing gas. And basically, we'll close a window that we could have opened. This is why I said, it's a tragedy to have a deliverance like no winter and then have people say, oh, my gosh, now we've really screwed up. We have too much gas. Because natural gas is now a heat product. It's used vociferously when it's cold, and it's used vociferously when it's hot. So if we don't have any summer this summer, we will have a glut of natural gas. If we have a big heat wave, you watch our glut disappear like dew in the morning. So we're balanced between a very delicate, maybe just a little tiny bit too much to not have a crisis, and a pure crisis. And we don't know anymore how to deal with cushion. This is what's so screwy about. We took our energy system. You know, part of this was sort of the mantra of the last two or three decades of coming to just-in-time everything. We like just-in-time. We like just-in-time gratification. We like just-in-time supply. We tore up contracts. Oh, those are fuddy-duddy. Contracts. Who would ever have a long-term contract in energy? Enron did their bit, too. It was amazing when I look back, because I fought those Enron guys all during the 90s saying, it was interesting when Jeff Skilling, that's now become a verb versus a verb. Now, Jeff and I would be on, because we're both Harvard Business School guys, we're both in Houston. I'd get on a panel and say, we have some grievous problems for natural gas building up, and we're burying our heads in the sand. Jeff would get up and say, with all due respect, Matt, I can buy 20 years natural gas supply on the telephone. You just understand trading and technology. And I'd say, well, Jeff, some of these are lying to you, you're lying to us. I had no idea, actually, that he was actually that. I was saying that euphemistically. But so I think that if it would be tragic if we were spared a real bona fide crisis because we had abnormally mild weather, and then we panicked that we'd basically had too much gas.
Mr. Simmons, I'd like to thank you for really doing a great job investigating this very unpopular subject. My name is Andrew Stern. I'm from a project in Hull, Massachusetts. It's an advocacy group that works on community-based wind projects, totally self-funded. We work with municipalities and other towns to install wind within the town borders. We just installed the second of two machines, a 1.8-megawatt machine in Hull. And I have to agree with you, especially bring people to Aberdeen for natural gas. The same thing with these installations. I'm a self-proclaimed wind weenie. But I believe that most of these renewable technologies should be mainstream and not alternative.
Yeah.
And do the right thing in the right place. You don't want to necessarily put a wind farm next to an airport. But we understand where the majority of the folks live are on either coast or very close, are also very good wind resources. As a matter of fact, Maine is a pretty decent wind resource. We just had folks from Freedom as well as the mayor and his administration from Saco, Maine, down. Because it's been a very popular project, very successful, and with a documented 95% approval rating within the town. How can we, sitting in this room here that do care an awful lot about the environment, turn this fossil fuel, which really isn't fossils, right? Fossils, something precious that you keep in a museum, and have folks understand that it's a very poisonous, noxious fuel, and that the very best thing that can result from using all this fossil fuel is years of employment cleaning up the environment.
Yeah.
Can you help us? And just one other thing, because there is groups, for example, in Massachusetts that have been set up to help foster the growth, and they have hundreds of millions of dollars, but yet cannot seem to get an installation going where a group of self-proclaimed wind weenies can get two machines, one already paid for itself in 4 years. Do we kick those guys out and start anew, or?
You know, I guess it, It's interesting. There's an association that some people think are a group of six, but it's a very, very fine association called ASPO, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. And basically, a year ago, they decided to break it up into country by country. And so ASPO USA had its first big program in Denver in early December, and 450 people showed up. In October, I think it's the 25th of October, 25th, 26th, the program has moved to Boston, and it's being co-sponsored by Boston University. And I would encourage all of you to watch for ASPO and come to the, because there you have a collection of the best minds in conservation, the best minds in all the various forms and it's a very serious forum. I think what has to happen is just educate, educate, educate. And I think, you know, there's a great person we're going to be sitting at this dinner with tomorrow night, General Dick Lawson, who started his military career as a private, and he retired as a four-star, and a really important four-star. And Dick basically we've just finished a program that he wrote me onto, that's why I'm on the Atlantic Council, called Clean Air for Asia. It's a comprehensive blueprint of how India and China can basically start to advance their societies without blackening the skies of Asia. And it was a four-nation effort, United States, Japan, India, and China. Dick Lawson, basically being a military man, caught everyone's attention when he said, first of all, there is no bad form of modern energy. Every form of modern energy is better than having no energy. The single biggest pollutants on Earth are basically using dung and using charcoal. I mean, there's just hundreds of bad things that happen. So you got to start out with there is no bad form of energy. And then secondly, you got to basically say, if you don't have reliable energy, you can't invent enough generals. And since he was a big, important four-star, that sort of has some impact. So I just think these community clubs really make a difference. They make a huge difference.
Couple quickies for you. One, what is your view of the refinery capacity issue? There are people who say that the big oil companies or refining companies don't want to build anymore because they know peak oil is either coming or here. Secondly, why isn't it in the interest of producing countries like, say, Saudi Arabia and Venezuela, for that matter, as well as also being good for the environment, to get as much money as they can? Why? I think you mentioned in passing Saudi Arabia was trying to keep the price down. Why would they want to keep the price down unless they're in league with, you know, in geopolitical ways with interests, for example, in the United States? And finally, on natural gas, in Harpswell, Maine, you may know probably that people voted down a liquid natural gas facility recently, which I was sympathetic to their vote.
I was too.
And so, could you expand a little on what you see as the dangers, the problems with natural gas, and why a guy like Jim Gordon, who's pushing Cape Wind, got out of liquid natural gas?
Yeah, let me start. Can you remind me of the first? Because the first was...
The first was refining.
Yeah, the refining issue is a very serious issue. We're out of capacity. Even worse, most of our refineries were built to process light oil, which doesn't need a huge amount of cracking, and most of the oil that we have left is non-light oil. So it's not just that we're out of capacity, we really need to rebuild most of our refineries. The major oil companies have zero interest in doing this. They lost money in this business for 30 years. They hate the business. I mean, what I find sort of amazing is that the major oil companies were dumping their refineries as fast as they could to these companies like Valero and Premcor, and they were buying them and paying them out in cash in a year. But the major oil companies, in my opinion, will not build a new refinery until you put bayonets behind them and say, out the door. So we just ought to get off that. The government is being fed a bunch of baloney, saying we don't really need new refineries. We have so much refinery capacity creep, and that just isn't right. But so you're hearing Secretary Bodman now saying, I'm kind of losing hope. Maybe the U.S. government will build refineries on military bases. And we had a very interesting meeting in our office for 2 days, and as a result of that, I have a good friend that's in Libya today with three representatives from the governor of Louisiana and two representatives from Libya, and then senior representatives from the old construction company, it used to be called Morrison Knutson, And they're talking about the state of Louisiana building a new modern refinery supported by a 20 to 25 year contract of sweet oil from Libya, and then using that as a way to train the Libyans in going further and further downstream, and using this as a role model of what should happen. So that's, but it's tragic that people in the refining business got so blindsided to 25 years of losing money that they didn't realize that the capacity had run out, and therefore this was going to be the golden days again, and they just hate the business. So why didn't Saudi Arabia, you know, it's hard to actually get inside a country's head, from all I've read, I think basically the old owners of Aramco, who happen to be these four companies, Exxon, Chevron, Texaco, and Mobil, led Saudi Arabia to believe, because they believed it for a long time, your fields will never run dry. You have more oil than you can ever imagine. And then they started listening to economists that said, the way you're going to kill the golden goose is if you ever get prices so high that basically you get your market taken away. So they remained an oil dove all through this OPEC stuff in the 70s because they didn't want to get the price too high. They never, ever realized that actually, when they found their last field, they still thought they barely started exploring. So it was really just a whole massive miscommunication, and that's what I think I've done a pretty good job of outlining in Twilight in the Desert. LNG. I helped organize the symposium at Bowdoin College that got about 300 people, and this idiot came up and shoved a pie in the face of Baldacci's, the nice girl, Beth, whatever her name is, saying, give that to John. It was just awful. What I basically said at this forum is LNG is not very good. I mean, it would terrify me to be in Boston Harbor every time, because they aren't likely to explode. But if they do, it's the energy content of several nuclear bombs. I mean, it would certainly wipe all the windows out in downtown Boston. So it's just say, if you have to do that, it's better than nothing. But also, we don't have any really known sources of supply to fill up these gasification terminals. And so I've said it seems to me that if Maine basically doesn't do anything, then we need to start dismantling all the industry in Maine and go home. So if it were up to me, first of all, I would never, ever let an LNG facility, if I had anything to do with it, come in Penobscot Bay. Because I look out my window and I see in the summer coming through Penobscot Bay, you got to be joking, an aircraft carrier, that's the size these are. But I think drilling in the Gulf of Maine for natural gas, there are known seeps of methane outside of Belfast. And so I thought, wouldn't it be awful if we actually went to the mat on LNG, we build a big LNG facility, and we found that all we would have needed done is put a small rig on a barge and actually have some underground natural gas we didn't even see coming to Belfast from right outside of Belfast.
I read your book 6 months ago, and I loved it. Apparently, I was a little too early. I didn't.
That was the hardback. The paperback you can get.
Yes. I'd like to challenge you a little with all due respect. It seems that to me that one of the main lessons in your book is fossil fuels are finite. And however much we have, which is in debate, you put a lot of numbers on it, it is finite, and eventually it will run out. Whether we're talking 3 months, 6 months, 6 years, or 60 years, it's going to run out. If I apply that same logic to geothermal, which you said you love, it seems to me that the heat in the earth is finite. It's staggering in quantity.
Yeah.
I don't see any possibility of it running out in my lifetime or my children's or my grandchildren's, but isn't it just another form of mining the earth? And what happens when we cool the earth's surface as a result of pulling heat out from 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet or whatever?
Yeah. First of all, I really don't know the first thing about that, but I'll tell you one of the things that I've heard that really impressed me. There's an old friend of mine in Norway, and he's a professor at the University of Trondheim, and he's basically patented, and he has two or three kinks, but he's got some powerful European companies putting some money on it. It's basically a drilling machine that creates a hole about 3,000 or 4,000 feet deep.
Yes.
And basically, then you take water and put it down the hole, and it comes out hot water.
Yes, that's correct.
So I don't know that you're really taking any energy balance out.
Well, you're heating the water that you're putting down.
Yeah.
You're using heat pumps with coefficient performance. I believe the theoretical is about 7, but the actuality for water source is about 5 or 5.2.
Yeah.
You're putting a huge amount of electricity into running those heat pumps. Yes, at 5.2, you get a benefit when you start at 30% or 20% efficiency, but you're now subtracting from that all the electrical energy to go to a head of 2,000 feet, which takes a lot of energy to pump water that high. And by the time you've worked out all of the calculations, I have actually seen heat pumps with coefficients of performance of 0.9.
Yeah.
And it sold lots of people, you know, like it, but it seems to me, A, we are mining the earth, and if we keep cooling the rocks down there with water, we're going to make an impact. I don't know when, but we're going to make an impact, and we're using an awful lot of electricity to do it. We're moving from fossil from natural gas, methane, which we could, in fact, produce, as a fuel source to produce heat, and I prefer solar, but we're moving from that to using electricity to get heat, hopefully at a better efficiency than the electricity is created. It just doesn't make sense to me.
First of all, I don't have any answers on natural gas. I was actually being a little bit optimistic because I don't know enough about the geothermal. What's so interesting is that if you don't have natural gas, then you have coal. Long, long, long time to get coal to burn. You can't put it out. Or you have electricity. And the best in the United States we have today, it doesn't matter whether a coal-fired plant, a cogen plant, or an oil-fired plant, it's still about 3-1 BTUs in for every BTU out.
That's correct.
And then it's an awfully inefficient way to heat. So then you say, well, why do we need heat? Well, it's pretty simple. We have an enormous part of the population that lives too far above the equator, and they get cold. And, you know, one of the things that honestly worried me when I read that NEPOOL report in October is I thought, you know, if we had I was sort of selfishly thinking about our property in Maine. I thought if we had a blackout in the winter that lasted 10 days, you could probably knock out a very big portion of the elderly population in New England because there's no place to move them. The gas station shut down, and hypothermia. I mean, you know, there was a lady that fell into Camden Harbor about a year and a half ago during the middle of February. It was an amazing struggle to get her out of the Camden Harbor in 5 minutes because they were afraid about 10 minutes she'd be dead. So I think that if we don't have heat, you can basically get along with a lot of other things, but heat actually is far more important than natural gas, than oil. So, but I don't know what the answer is. It's a very serious problem.
Thank you.
Hi. Barring political disruptions, what are you willing to predict about the supply-demand curve for fossil fuels? And if America let the industry punch holes everywhere they wanted, what difference would it make?
Oh, you know, I've really shied away from trying to have some fancy long-term formula. But several times, NPR had a program about 6 weeks ago, and they said, you know, we'd really like on our website to have your forecast versus all these others. And I said, okay, just make sure you ask it and say, this is an off-the-top-of-my-head forecast. So it's not a – I said, and this is just oil. We're today using about 85 million barrels a day. And by 2010, I would say – you know, most likely case would be around 78 to 80. 2015, most likely case, 70 to 75. 2020, most likely case, 60 to 65. And she said, but that can't happen. Well, why? Well, demand needs to be 120. I said, that's the problem. As you see, you know, we build a society that basically we're barreling along. I mean, you know, this morning there was a news report that said Taiwan in April, their oil demand was up 11% year over year. So we're building a society where we needed 120. And if we're producing 60 million barrels a day, we certainly haven't run out of oil. That's an enormous amount of oil, but it's an unbelievable gap. Yeah, one of the impossibilities of if we just let everything rip and drilled wells everywhere, we're out of drilling rigs. We're totally out of drilling rigs. Now you say, well, we can just build rigs. Well, the world has 3,000 drilling rigs, plus or minus a couple of hundred, and on average, they're 25 years old. You ever driven a 25-year-old car? So in the next 10 years, we need to rebuild 2,500 to 3,000 drilling rigs, and that's more rigs we've ever built ever. So we've run out the clock there, too. Yeah. You can't dismiss any form of localized supply that works because it works locally. So if we basically found a lot of gas in New England, it would be fabulous for New England, but it wouldn't have any impact for the world.
Could you give us an idea of what burning or extracting and transporting so much oil and coal, these fossil fuels, actually, I'm sure it's in the book, but the effect on a daily basis, because I don't think people get that. When I talk to people about wind, they come up with stuff like microclimates. A wind farm can affect the micro. It's great, but when you talk about the sheer waste of
I'll tell you what, one of the things that I find so amazing is that almost every time I get into an area that I say, well, I don't know much about that. Let me look. If you hit this data screen again, you can't believe how skimpy the data is on the BTU value of energy and how you even basically, well, somebody years ago came up with a BTU equivalent of a volume of oil versus a mass of vapor. And it's apples and oranges. You can't even compare the two. The CO2 statistics that people take so seriously, there's a totally different CO2 standard. You can't measure CO2, so it's an assumption. There's a totally different CO2 assumption in Europe for these plants than there is in the United States. Within the United States, you have about four different groups that have, and because they're all assumptions. So it's just remarkable of how many of their fights we have are made over data we say is perfect, but it's just an assumption of data. I mean, yeah, there's no question that wind basically is clean. What I find interesting, I tried to pin down one day when I was speaking actually at the Clean Wind Program in Chicago, I was sitting next to the new guy running GE's wind. I said, how much energy goes into one of your big 300-meter? Not a lot. I said, that wasn't what I asked. How much? It couldn't be much. I said, well, didn't I read that the one blade is like the wing of a 747? Yeah, they're really big. And there's no energy content that goes into that. So we don't even know with the wind turbines even. Now, when you get wind for a small village or something, the turbines don't have to be so massive. But so in this whole area, it's just a lack of data. People get passionate. You get so many people that are actually selling something. What I'm selling is that, you know, my CAFE standard car is at 28 miles per gallon. Well, the tragedy is, you know, when I said we went from Houston to Fort Worth back to Houston, we were in a Mercedes diesel. That fabulous diesel, I turned my BMW 740 in, and this is far better car. It's faster to drive. It's more fun to drive. And we actually averaged, I had my meter going the whole time. My meter's the little thing, your dashboard. In 275 miles each way, we averaged 35 miles to the gallon. And so that's why it took us basically 17 and a half gallons to basically go round trip. The foes of diesel fought that for 5 years to not let those great engines from Europe come to the United States because they hated the word diesel. It just didn't sound good to them. They were thinking about those old junky diesels we had in the 70s. So I just think one of the things we need to do is just get off the soapbox and get back on when you've done your homework.
So I just was hoping the follow-up would be this is important stuff. It's fossil fuel pollution. I would like to know the daily, you know.
I don't know.
But it's just some huge. We saw the blackouts in the Northeast, how the area cleaned up over those couple days.
You know what's interesting, though, is that it depends on the car. This handkerchief test that I see once in a while, you can basically put a handkerchief. I've never done this, but I'm told you can put a handkerchief on the exhaust of this Mercedes diesel, and it's clean. You put a handkerchief on some other car, and it's just black within minutes. But so you say there isn't an average car.
Thank you very much, Matthew Simmons. Please join me.